And ladies and gentlemen, you notice I didn't say all you lot. Tonight, take this opportunity to speak to you on the Dhamma. They always want titles for these talks. Tonight's title is taken from a Thai phrase, a kind of literal translation of a Thai phrase, which means being the knowing. In the Thai language, that's how I actually learned meditation and actually practiced the Dhamma, was through learning the Thai language and practicing in that country. So as far as it's kind of a native Dharma language for me. And you can say some very wonderful things very succinctly in Thai language, a monosyllabic language, tonal like Chinese, and it has a tremendous ability to give kind of suggestions and innuendo. But just a simple phrase in Thai is yugapuru, which means being the knowing. And this is what we call the way of practice, a direct teaching. There is also a very fine book in Thai published years ago called The Light of the Dhamma, the Dhamma Patipa. And this I found a tremendous help to me in my years in Thailand as a kind of meditation guide. And this was, we've translated several chapters of it into English, but I haven't had time to translate the whole thing. But this monk, Thai monk, who's now dead, uses this phrase very much, being the knowing. And notice that the Buddha's teachings are all about this being awake and knowing, being attentive, alert. And this is the way of a Buddha, by understanding the way things are. In the Thai language also, the word for nature is Dhamma. They use the Pali word Dhamma as their word for nature. When they talk about communing with nature or studying nature, it's studying the Dhamma. This is the word the Thai people use as an everyday, ordinary word for nature. Where to us, sometimes nature is relegated to kind of flowers and trees, things that we consider natural in a good sense. But we sometimes regard the rest of our life as quite unnatural. Because we don't really know the way things are. We just have various assumptions and positions that we take through our conditioning, through our perceptions, without questioning, without investigating or putting any effort into our lives, in just observing how things really are, as one can observe as a human being, as an individual, as a person. Now you might think that you have to be a scientist to really understand nature, study biology and botany, all these other things, in order to a naturalist or a nature lover or even a poet, some kind of extreme position one might take in an artistic appreciation of nature or a scientific one. But this way of a Buddha is understanding nature as we can know it, each one for ourselves, not from any position or from any particular talent. Whether one is talented or untalented, or rich or poor, male or female, we observe the way things are as we can observe them, as we are able to see and understand Dhamma, the way it is. So being the knowing isn't trying to become knowledgeable about anything or acquire any kind of knowledge about nature or the universe, the cosmos, but in opening the mind to the way things really are. And for this way, the Buddha gave very specific teachings and suggestions for us to follow, not telling us the way things are. If you notice, the Buddha's teachings are not doctrines or dogmas that you must believe in. He's not telling you how it is, but he's pointing to the way it is. That pointing, as Trevor Leggett was talking about last night, a pointing, a way of looking at the way things are. Now, if I tell you the way it is, then you can agree or disagree with me. I say, this is the way it is, and you believe me. And anyone that doesn't believe me, get out of here. Or we can tie you up, put you in the cellar, and brainwash you. One can force perceptions on people, brainwash them, and out of fear and just persistent conditioning, reconditioning of the mind, one can actually start believing almost in anything at all. One can just reject and say, I don't believe him, I think he's crazy. These are the two extreme positions, either total belief or total disbelief. But pointing to the way things are means that we reflect on the way it is. We're not trying to say it has to be any certain way, any particular way at all, but just notice. Begin to notice things that you wouldn't notice before. Being the knowing means being alert now. It's not like acquiring some kind of ability to become knowledgeable in the future. And this is the way we tend to think. We tend to even regard Buddhist meditation practice as a kind of accumulative process where we acquire samadhi. Over the years, we develop concentration, and then we go from this stage to the next. And then finally, after all those hard years, all that slogging through killing off the kilesas and defilements and renouncing the world, suddenly it happens. The great enlightenment, there you are, Buddha, and you think, I doubt if that'll ever happen to me. To give up my puppy dog and my kitty cat, I can't do that, not even for the Buddha. So sometimes we think that this path is just asking too much of us, because we have these ideas about we take it to an extreme position. But seeing or knowing the way things are means opening right now. It's being the knowing at this moment. How do you do that? What do I have to do to be the knowing now? Because once one says something like this, then of course you want to know what to do. And say, open the mind up. And say, how do you open the mind up? Just to the way it is. And you say, what way is it? Now, as an individual being, we can only know on a certain level. We can't know from the macrocosmic position of God about everything in the universe. To try to know what's on Jupiter and Mars and how it all began in the infinite mystery in the universe, even though we can speculate and we can have various views about it, we can't really know that, because our position is that of a human being, meaning, now consider what this means, being contained within a human form on an earth for a lifespan, for however long this body lives. Now this is our position. We recognize that this is the way it is. For this lifetime, and say, even though I might want to know everything about everything and all the fascinating and solve all the mysteries and know how it all began and what will happen and solve everything, become omniscient, what can I know under the limitations I find myself as I am at this moment. So ask yourself this question. What is it that each one of us, as a person, as an individual, can know at this moment? And this is what the Buddha pointed to in his teaching of the Four Noble Truths. Because these Four Noble Truths are what you can actually know at any given moment when you awaken to the way things are. Now these truths are not kind of, they're not beliefs. A truth can be realized. It's not a belief, cannot be, you have to more or less accept it on faith, don't you? There is a God, and we can believe, we can disbelieve. But say at this moment, how do we can know that we believe in God or we don't? That we can know. We can know that we're not sure. We can know that this idea of God that we have might have a particular idea of what that is. But this we can know, that whatever we believe in or disbelieve in at this moment, that is a condition of the mind itself. Beliefs in God, or beliefs that there aren't, that there isn't any, that is a condition that arises and passes according to other conditions. This we can know, that whatever arises, whatever is subject to arising, is subject to ceasing. And this you can practice with in daily life just by noting that whatever you see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think, or feel, any condition that passes through the mind, no matter how gross or how subtle it is, how important or unimportant it might be, how true or how false, how good or how evil its quality might be, it is something that arises and ceases. Now, when the Buddha gave his first sermon in the deer park in Benares to the five disciples, now that is that first sermon, the Dhammajaka Sutta. Now that is a sutta that we at our monastery use for our practice. It's the teaching that we have reflected on for years. So that sutta is chanted by the monks and nuns, and in the Pali language we chant it, and we use that very sutta, that first sermon, for a kind of constant reflection on the way things are. So over years, say, of meditation, this very sutta has become just a very skillful tool for understanding and reflecting and contemplating the nature of things. Now, according to some forms of Buddhism, that sutta is kind of basic. So you study that at a correspondence course and then give it away for something more advanced. But actually, I found through practice it's not something that one just studies and learns from the intellect, but it actually is a very useful reflection for everything that happens in our experience as a human being, just for human existence in daily life. Because you're talking, this sutta is about the way things are, as we can witness them, as individual beings, as human beings, as men or as women, as monks, nuns, or as lay people. All that is subject to arising is subject to cessation. Now, when the Buddha gave this sermon, in the sutta itself, the sutta that we chant, after he finished the sermon, then the five disciples, all were grateful, were joyous that they heard this. But it was only one disciple that really understood it. And then the sutta goes on into this kind of fantastic jubilation Suddenly, all the deva realms, from the lowest, from the Puma devas, the fairies and elves on the earth, send forth this resonant sound throughout the universe, proclaiming that the wheel of the Dhamma has been turned, and that goes on to the next realm, to the four Maharajas, and then up to the god Indra in the Tawadingsa heaven, and on up to the Yama, Nimanarati, Parinimitta, the Tusita, Nimanarati, and Parinimitta Vasavati, Devalokas. And then if you're really a serious and dedicated Pali chanter, you carry it up through the Brahma realms into the highest deva, highest realm, celestial realms. Now this is quite dramatic, isn't it? Suddenly, the Buddha just says, his sermon, which amounts to all that is subject to arising is subject to cessation, and then all these celestial beings start their kind of resounding joy. And at the end of this, after all that drama, the Buddha calmly says, Kondanya knows, Anya Kondanya. And so this, that, and that is the end of the Dhammajaka Sutta. Now contemplating that, you think, here is the story of the Buddha who gave up a kingdom and all the pleasures of the material world and the social world to become an ascetic, where he gained powers of the mind, and then gave all that up for the realization of the way things are, the truth or the Dhamma. Feeling inclined to go and try to find those and relate what he discovered to those that he knew, he went to the deer park in Benares and found these disciples who previously had kind of rejected him because they felt that he had kind of given up and become soft after all those years of asceticism. They caught him one day eating some milk rice, and this is, I guess, like a monk eating ice cream or something. It's a sign of weakness or indulgence. Like if you saw me sitting on the bench eating an ice cream cone, some of you might lose faith. Edible tomatoes nowhere. The five disciples saw that, I suppose, milk rice in those days was something like that, a luxury, after he'd been eating nettle soup for years. So these disciples had deserted him, but then they were obviously men who had good intentions for realization of truth, and out of their sincerity and earnestness had missed the point of what the monk Gotama was doing, which gave him the chance to leave all that and meditate, contemplate, reflect on the way things are to realize the Dhamma for himself. Then going to Benares, giving that sermon, and then the rejoicing, and then the Buddha prays, notice what the Buddha says, this is a kind of a gladness and joyousness from the Buddha's mind, Anya Kondanya. It's Kondanya knows, being the knowing. So out of those five disciples, notice all the devas, all those elevated celestial beings just rejoice at things. They can't actually be enlightened themselves. They just get terribly enthusiastic about other people doing it. But the ascetic Kondanya understood. Meaning, and what is it that Kondanya understood? All that is subject to arising is subject to ceasing, and that's all you can say. And yet to us that seems, does not very much, does it? Kind of a barren teaching. When we think we'd like to know everything about everything. Surely the Buddha must have discovered something absolutely fantastic, something stupendous. But yet, what he gives in his first sermon is, all that is subject to arising is subject to ceasing. That there's a way out of this ignorance. That his teaching is pointing to the way out of just being endlessly deluded by the appearance of that which arises and ceases. So our way of practice, say, as Buddhists, are to, say, follow that teaching and to consider, not to just blindly follow it. It's not a teaching that blinds, but it's a teaching that awakens you. To awaken to that teaching means that you must open your mind to the way things are, not to the way you think things are or the way you believe it is, but the way it is. And so the way it is that whatever you're feeling, thinking, whatever is happening at this moment, if it's subject to arising, it's subject to ceasing. Now that applies to absolutely every condition, dhamma, good or bad, indifferent. Now that, through that knowledge of arising and that which arises is ceases, we begin to realize, let's say, that these things that are arising and ceasing are not self. Meaning before that we tended to identify with these conditions. If you never question, never open your mind to the Dhamma, to the way things are, then you're caught in reacting to the quality of the conditions you're experiencing. And these are very conditioned reactions according to so many other things. How you were brought up, what your society was like, your culture, what class, what your family, teachers and so forth. These are different qualitative perceptions that we have. We've learned how to react to beauty and ugliness, pleasure and pain, the sensory world. Just as sensitive beings, just like any other sensitive beings, the animal kingdom reacts to the qualities of the conditioned world. And we react to the qualities of the conditioned world. Now this is natural, saying it's not wrong or bad to react to the quality of the conditions, because we can't help it, it's a natural thing, the reactions we have, such as the beauty, being attracted to beauty. They look at this flower arrangement. It's attractive, isn't it? The flower is an attractive thing. It attracts us. When we see it, we want to look at it. That's nature. That's not a kind of defilement of the mind. That's not like a personal defilement or weakness to see and be attracted to the beauty of the flower kingdom. But in reflecting on that, we begin to be aware of this attraction as something that comes from the five khandhas and the way things are, rather than as a personal quality. Where before, our attraction and repulsion would be identified very much as personal, as self, as me and mine. And we don't question that, because that's the way it seems, that's the way it appears, that's the way everybody believes it to be anyway. So there's no reason, really, to question that until we begin to really contemplate, like Siddhartha Gautama did. What is it all about anyway? Old age, sickness, death. Religion. What is all this about anyway? One can just follow the attractive and repulsive natural instincts of our condition. Say, or one can observe those, witness to that. So when one sees a flower, one can see the flower and also see and also reflect on the attractiveness, the movement of one's own mind, the way one wants to hold on or grasp or absorb into what is beautiful, or to get away, suppress, run away from what is unpleasant or ugly. Because we aren't just conditioned creatures, just kind of puppets in nature that are just hopelessly addicted to these powers of attraction and repulsion. We can actually witness these powers, these movements of the mind and body. Now, this is what we mean by not self. It means that if we were just that, if we were just a human body and feelings and thoughts and perceptions, there'd be no way out of it. We'd just have to be that way. We wouldn't even be able to reflect on it or understand it in any way. For example, the animal kingdom. If I've reflected a lot, contemplated animals at Chithurst, and the cat, little cat that lives there, I've noticed, cannot reflect on herself. Now, this might upset the cat lovers, and I don't want to do that. So I'm not kind of, if you see that I'm wrong, I'm quite willing to be, if you want to inform me that they aren't this way, then please tell me. This is just from what I've observed, is that when little Dorothy is greedy, she becomes exactly that greed. Like, for example, on a day when people bring a lot of fish and chicken, Doris can be quite equanimous a lot of the time, lying in her chair, sleeping and snoring. But when the smell of fish or chicken enters the monastery, she loses that equanimity completely. And even though all the nuns and monks have tried to advise her on this problem, it's been to no use whatsoever. This is how many years? It's nearly 7 years now we've been at her. Because she becomes exactly what that feeling is, greed. The whole body, the whole movement is completely absorbed into the desire to get that fish. Now I think we can understand that kind of reaction. Even though we would try to think of ourselves as having a little more self-control than Doris. But actually, that is a similar reaction we have when we see something that is terribly attractive and desirable to us. We can become obsessed, completely obsessed, with that desire for it. But also, we can reflect on that desire. For example, and suddenly you bring an ice cream cone in the room here, and I suddenly absolutely all go crazy over this ice cream cone. You can say, Venerable Sumedha, you told us to reflect on greed. I think, oh yes. So then I can start observing this tremendous greed that has arisen in my mind. I can reflect, I can see it, I can observe its feeling, the effect it has on the body itself and the mind. And I can endure till it ceases. If I'm really willing to observe this, I can patiently endure and watch that greedy feeling end. This is what I mean by the reflexive ability of a human being. The same with hatred. When little Doris is angry, she's completely that. There's no way she can witness her own anger. But I've seen in myself that when I feel angry, whatever mood happens to arise in my mind, I can turn to that very condition and observe it. I can endure it. I can wait with it till it ceases. And this is what the Buddha was pointing to when he was talking about mindfulness, awareness, clear comprehension, understanding, wisdom of the way things are. That whatever is subject to arising is subject to ceasing, and whatever is subject to arising and cessation is not what one is. And that's being the knowing. So we work with just the ordinary, simple frustrations and greeds and compulsions that we actually have as individual beings. This is our karma, or what we have as individual personalities, as beings, that we can use skillfully for understanding the truth of the way things are. So this is another reason why the Buddha said it's through understanding this, it's through understanding it yourself, through using this body as it is, no matter what it is, how healthy or how unhealthy, how young or old, male or female, whatever it is, one can use that for this reflection. The conditions of one's mind, the way one's character is, the emotions that we have, the fears, the desires, all this is our path by reflecting on it. Where we tend to think that these maybe are obstacles to us. We think, I have such a problem with anger. And I don't think I could ever be enlightened in this lifetime because I get so angry. I have such a problem with anger. And I don't think I could ever be enlightened in this lifetime because I get so angry. So then we believe that anger is a problem, and when we believe in those things, then we are constantly recreating situations where that kind of condition will prove that we will reinforce that conviction, won't it? In fact, we make the problem ourselves out of our fixation on it. We get angry and we feel we shouldn't get angry, and then we try to stop being angry, and then we get angry, and then we say something we shouldn't, and then we feel guilty, and then we think, I'm a hopeless case. And then you think, I'll not do that again. And then you do it again, and then you feel guilty, and I'm a hopeless case. And after a while, it seems, actually, everybody's saying, you know, you're a hopeless case. Because that's you believe it, they believe it, and then there's no reason for anyone to disbelieve it. Until you awaken to the fact that that is not self, that anger is something that arises and ceases and is not self. And just that reflection, that perspective on it, means that the force of that particular condition fades out a little bit. Once you see things as they really are, then their karmic force begins to cease, the fading out process. But as long as you're completely committed to these habits of yours and believe that they're really problems of yours and that they're hopeless or that you've got to get rid of them or you make a lot out of them, then of course you never really see them as they really are. They always become more than what they are. They become complicated, convoluted, complex. They go every which way. And then they become so confusing, then you have to get rid of them. Start taking all kinds of drugs or have a breakdown or something. The other realization the Buddha pointed to is the realization of Nibbana. Now one can know by being the knowing, one can know conditions as conditions, and one can know the unconditioned as the unconditioned. Now to most beings, unawakened people who don't understand the way things are, then they tend to just know the conditions, but not really know them as conditions, but believe those conditions are me and mine, or you, or them. So that those conditions are never questioned, never seen in a perspective, they're always just reacted to, either indulgent or suppressed, ignored, in some way, so the reaction is mainly to the conditioned world, the sensory world. So we never are aware when there aren't any conditions or when there isn't any grasping our memories are through grasping. We remember just the grasping aspects of our lives, extreme pleasures or pains, or important occasions, or great embarrassments or humiliations. But in daily life, there are many moments in our lives where there is no attachment to anything, but we don't know that because we're not mindful. We don't reflect on the way things are. We just tend to react. So in mindfulness, the way of mindfulness and awareness and reflection on the way things are, we become increasingly more aware of emptiness when there is no grasping of anything. Now that realization, when there's no grasping, that's also the realization of Nibbana, when there is no grasping of the five khandhas. Now this means that we aren't always grasping the five khandhas, but we don't know, we aren't aware when we're not. We're only caught up in the movement of those conditions, so we just tend to be caught in these cycles of habit and identifying with those cycles. So with meditation, as you begin to really penetrate and observe in a continuous way, putting forth a continuous kind of right amount of effort and reflection on the way things are, we began to also be aware of non-grasping. And the blissful state of the mind when there's no movement to grasp anything. Now some of you might have actually had moments in your life where you actually realized that state, and suddenly a very kind of peaceful state, blissful state, when you don't know quite what happened, but suddenly there wasn't any more fear or anxiety or desire. It's just clarity, awareness, brightness. I think, what was that? So then we because we don't know what it is, then we can call it anything. We say, oh, God spoke to me, or whatever. You can interpret it as any kind of, through any kind of concept. But notice that in Buddhism, the Buddha does not interpret that as anything other than non-grasping. So many of you, I noticed, try to find out, want a name for the ultimate truth, and want to know, want to, you know, pushing the mind to through the intellect to try to find out what is the ultimate realization, or who is it that knows? What is it that knows? Is it the real self, or the, or God, or is it, what is it? Now the Buddha was very skillful in understanding the way the human mind works, and it grasps, will grasp at anything. He also said, sape tama anatta. As well as he said, sape sankara anicca, all conditions are impermanent. And then he adds, sape tama anatta, all dhamma is not self. Now this is not doctrinal Buddhism either. But this is the final stroke of genius. As a great psychologist, the Buddha realized this. Now notice in your own, this desire to know who it is, what it is that knows. Is it the consciousness, knowing consciousness? Is it the big I, or the little I, or the big self, or whatever? That desire to know that ultimate truth has to be relinquished. We have to even let go of the desire to know the truth. Now this, I see, I like to give this example from a different religious tradition, how I interpret it. And I've asked Christians whether they think this is a fair enough interpretation. Most agree with me. It's been approved by some Christians. But it's just a Buddhist monk's interpretation. Now, when they say the crucifixion of Jesus, now one consider that this is a story of great suffering, of human humiliation and pain, where the actual human body is nailed to a cross, stripped naked, made fun of, jeered at, every way humiliated, scorned, publicly executed between two thieves, where even his disciples leave him and desert him. And only people that remain is his mother and Mary Magdalene and St. John, kind of stand around looking absolutely miserable. These pictures in churches of the sorrowful virgin. Then this particular sign of where he says, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." Now imagine this, being nailed to a cross, publicly humiliated, kind of the worst of anything that can happen to a human being, and then being able to forgive. Obviously seeing that people only act like that when they're out of ignorance. When we really comprehend that people only do wicked and stupid things out of ignorance, not out of wisdom, then we can forgive them, don't we? We can forgive ourselves for the stupid things we do, when we realize that we do that, not from not understanding things properly. Then, after the forgiveness, and this is what we all have to do as Buddhists and as meditators, we have to be able to forgive everyone. And this is very important in practice of meditation. Just seeing so many people not being able to really get any kind of peace out of their practice because they never can forgive anything. They carry things around. They tend to suppress their feelings. They never allow their feelings to arise and to let them go. They never really come to terms with the repressed fears and anxieties in their own lives and the things that they've resented and feel bitter about. They tend to try to get rid of it, annihilate it sometimes. And as long as we do that, we'll never have any real peace at all. There's no way you can ever have a peaceful mind if you haven't forgiven. Then after all that, then he feels even God's deserted him. He says, "Why hast thou forsaken me?" So even at the very critical point, even God deserts him. The ultimate despair, isn't it? That cry of ultimate despair. Now that's also an important part of our practice. Because even the assumption that somehow God is with us and that there's somebody out there loving us and that it's all right as long as God stands by, we can endure anything. And then the doubt that even that, there's nothing. There's just total despair. Everything has left us. Even that which we had most faith in has disappeared. And that's a very powerful moment. And then the total surrender to that moment. This giving up to the limitations of the pain, the humiliation, the cross, without any kind of request or demand in any way whatsoever. Total surrender to the limitations of the earthly condition, the condition of that moment. Now that is an extreme example, I do admit. But it's also an example, say, a kind of archetype, religious archetype for us to reflect on. And most of us hopefully will never be subjected to such extreme forms of humiliation and pain and despair. But from what we do have on a much, say, less extreme level, how careful are we? How much can we learn from just the pain, the embarrassment, the problems and disappointments and the despair of our lives in just daily life experiences? How willing are we to forgive? How willing are we to give up to the moment rather than demand anything, special privileges? One thinks now, if Jesus Christ had really used his head, if he was really the Son of God, he would have jumped off the cross, proclaimed himself. He would have had an enormous following. It would have been terribly impressive. And everybody would have cheered. His mother would have looked very happy. Would have made everybody happy. Well, some people would have felt that very threatening, but it would have been an enormous kind of impressive feat, wouldn't it? But yet, on the practical level of personal experience in the world as an individual human being, that very example of surrender to the limitations is what we all need to use in our own lives. Learning how to surrender to give up, not to resist the limitations we find ourselves in, but to humbly accept even the despair, the pain, the humiliation of our life as we can experience it, rather than crying out for somebody to save us or expect anything to happen or just to become bitter and blaming. As Buddhists now, reflect on this in your own life. What you can do just in your daily life, in your homes, with your families, and see how much of your life is caught up in egotistical kind of positions and demands and assumptions and blaming and criticizing and fault-finding with the way you are or your spouse or family or parents or society. Learning to forgive. Mm-hmm. Practicing that way of continuous forgiveness, like even oneself, being able to forgive oneself for one's own stupidities and failings in a continuous way. That doesn't justify stupidity, does it? We're not justifying, saying it's all right to be stupid, but it means that we can not make big problems around it. When we do something selfish or mean or unkind or just foolish, we can immediately recognize that and then let it go. Do not make a problem out of it. Forgive yourselves rather than carrying it around to the next moment, hating yourself for making a mistake, and then also applying that to others, to the people you live with, to the people you work with, to the people in the government, the society that we live in, the world that we live in. I found in meditation, just living in this human condition as it is, when sometimes life becomes very pleasant, sometimes all kinds of problems, difficult situations arise, things seem to go wrong, people misunderstand, and one starts thinking, oh, I can't stand this, I don't like this, I don't want the world to be this way. Or the only way out, I've found, the only really wise thing to do in those moments is to surrender to them, to allow misery to be the way it is, to see the misery of it as a condition that has arisen and will cease, and let go, and be patient. So the Buddha wisdom, this knowing whatever is subject to arising is subject to cessation, is a very humbling kind of wisdom. It doesn't swell your head up. You think you know everything. I know everything about everything though. What is it that one can know, definitely know at this moment, the way things happen to be at this moment, is that whatever is subject to arising is subject to cessation. We can know that. We can know non-attachment to whatever has arisen, whatever is ceasing. We can realize this. Sabbe sankharanicca, all conditions are impermanent. Sabbe tamanatta, all dhamma is not self. This sabbe tamanatta, there's nothing to call it. There's no name. There's no concept. We have to even let go of that final wish and desire for to know God, or to have that feeling that God is on our side. Even that security of feeling that God is on our side and he cares. Even give up that wish, that kind of noble aspiration to know just that much. Total surrender, and then you will know the peace of non-attachment, of seeing things as they really are, of the immortal truth. So that this new monastery we're establishing is called the Amaravati Monastery, the deathless realm, the place of immortality. Now, don't think that the actual physical place is the but I'm just pointing to, I'm using this word now for reflection and as for something new, each one of you to consider as something to use in your own lives to incline to the Amaravati. So that's enough for this time. Hope you will consider, reflect on what I've said this evening, and may it help you, may it be of use to you in your daily life.